Hey, business owners, quick question. When someone hears your phone number, do they remember it? Or does it get lost in the noise like every other 10-digit jumble? Let's fix that with Ring Boost, the go-to service for custom phone numbers that makes your business stand out. Whether you're running a small business or scaling something big, the right number makes it ridiculously easy for customers to remember you and actually call. You can grab a local number to connect with your regional audience or even a custom toll-free number like 1-800-HOME-CARE or 833-ROOFERS. Seriously, they've got options for every industry. Imagine you're a plumber. Would you rather your number end in 241-8297 or 888-LEAK? No brainer, right? And here's the best part. It's super affordable, super easy, and it can help drive more calls, more leads, and more trust. So, if you're ready to sound like the business people want to call, head over to ringboost.com and use promo code STRANGE for an exclusive discount. That's ringboost.com, promo code STRANGE. RingBoost, because voice matters.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe, discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in-stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. Knowing you could be saving money for the things you really want is a great feeling. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can choose to bundle and save with the personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Hey friends, welcome to another installment of Strange Planet. Buckle up for a mind-bending dive into the world of UAPs, UFOs, and disclosure with Nick Pope, the UK's former top UFO investigator, once the real-life Fox Mulder at the Ministry of Defense. He's now peeling back the curtain on government secrets and the high-stakes chess game of UAP disclosure. Is it truth or manipulation, controlled release or catastrophic reveal? He's here to unpack who's pulling the strings and why 2025 could change everything. Nick served 21 years at the UK Ministry of Defense, including a pivotal role leading its UFO project, tasked with investigating sightings using radar, military testimony, and classified intelligence. He had a front row seat to the official UAP probes. Now a global authority, Nick consults for media, testifies before Congress, and speaks at venues like the Pentagon and Royal Society. He's a staple on Ancient Aliens and Unidentified. He blends insider knowledge with a push for transparency on anomalous phenomena. He's the author of numerous books, including Open Skies, Closed Minds, The Uninvited, an expose of the alien abduction phenomenon, Operation Lightning Strike, Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, among others. And he'll be appearing at Contact in the Desert, which runs from May 29th to June the 2nd. More information at contactinthedesert.com. And his discussion will be to disclose or not to disclose. Nick Pope, welcome to Strange Planet. How are you?
Good, thank you. And thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Let's just start with a general question. The true agenda behind disclosure and your thoughts, is it really about revealing truth, or is it more of a carefully crafted intelligence operation?
I think it could be a bit of both, but it's a very good question. It's one that hardly ever gets asked. I think we often bat this subject around in a very binary kind of is it or isn't it way. But your question, what's the agenda here? What really, I think, gets to the heart of it. And if there was a simple, easy answer, I think we'd have it by now. Because, of course, this is a subject that comes with an 80-year backstory. So I think it's a key question, but I would split the question further and say, you know, when we talk about the agenda, we can talk about the government agenda. And even there, of course, it's not just the US government. There are other players too. But then you could flip it around and say, well, what about the phenomenon itself? You know, doesn't that get a vote? And actually, my answer to that would be it gets more than a vote. It might have the deciding say in all of this. And if we are truly dealing with something that demonstrates high strangeness, then who are we to really apply our sort of human anthropocentric mindset to a question that may be unknowable?
When we talk about, or when you talk about control disclosure, who is in charge, and are they managing public fear, or are they shaping narratives, or is it a bit of both?
I think when you hear the phrase controlled disclosure, which I then would compare and contrast to catastrophic disclosure, and I think it's important to stress what the difference is, there, I think it is the government that's in charge, or if not the government in a corporate sense, certainly a sort of believer faction, if I can call it that, or the gatekeepers, whoever it is that is really guardian of whatever trove of knowledge exists within, and this is the US government. You could say that other Five Eyes nations are involved, but it's clear that in the Five Eyes intelligence sharing alliance that the US has the lead. And you could say that adversaries like China and Russia obviously have their own UAP programs, but frankly, we don't know much about those. Mm-hmm. So we're left with the US government. And there, yes, this faction, whatever you want to call it, has for some years now been, I suppose I would use the phrase, drip feeding information about this, laying a trail of breadcrumbs, as it were, that, you know, the theory goes, is going to lead us up to the moment of disclosure with a big D, which is popularly characterized as you know, the president going live on TV saying, "My fellow Americans, people of the world, we are not alone." So controlled disclosure is the road that leads us up to that moment. And it's a road that is being paved with a little bit here, a little bit there, whether it's whistleblowers, photographs, videos, documents, whatever it is. But we've been in that process arguably since December 2017 and the New York Times article about ATIP and the US Navy videos.
And catastrophic disclosure, what would it unleash in your mind, and how close are we to it?
Catastrophic disclosure, unlike controlled disclosure, which probably has an end point in sight and a timeline that gets us there, catastrophic disclosure is what happens when controlled disclosure goes wrong. In other words, if it all suddenly comes out at once, either through an unauthorized leak or a whistleblower who doesn't play by the rules, whatever, you know, however that unfolds, or this is the more, I suppose, interesting and scary thought, if an adversary does it. I mentioned China and Russia have a program and that we don't know much about them. What if an adversary is sitting on the smoking gun and decides to fire it, and then decides to leverage that to create some sort of geopolitical advantage for themselves and chaos for everyone else? So that's catastrophic disclosure.
Some suggest that any type of disclosure, controlled or otherwise, would be catastrophic in terms of, you know, the world religions and the, you know, the petrodollar and so forth, that it would be so disruptive we couldn't handle it. Would you care to weigh in on that perspective?
Yes, I think there have been two schools of thought on this for many years. I mean, I heard people used to sort of quote the radio broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds and the panic that supposedly caused, though the extent of that is disputed. Then people started saying, no, no, we're ready for it. We can handle it. The John Alexander quote, which is something to the effect of, you don't shock people or scare people by telling them something they already believe. And then we had COVID. And then that kind of upended the thinking, I believe, because up until that point, you know, the idea that there was a sort of societal resilience held. And you could say, yeah, well, whether it's through documentaries or sci-fi, we're kind of used to the idea of aliens. It wouldn't be such a big shock. Then we had a global pandemic, which was hardly an unanticipated event. And it was hardly an event that we had not had before. And yet the world collectively lost its mind. Literally panic in the streets, whether it's over like toilet paper shortage or whether it was over people not wearing a mask and other people thinking they were going to die and the unvaccinated treated like 21st century lepers. What and you know, your freedoms don't matter in a pandemic and all the BS that came with it. But you know, whatever one believes about COVID, there's no getting away from the fact that society at every level, from the individual up to government at the federal level, did not handle it well. And that's something we had contingency plans for. So imagine these gatekeepers that I mentioned sort of thinking, well, if COVID was a sort of not deliberate, but a useful blueprint for how society might respond to something that came from left field and upended all our lives, those same gatekeepers will now be saying, my goodness, no, we're not ready. And you're right, going back to your question, yeah, this would deeply and profoundly impact every aspect of our lives, politics, religion, the economy, much more besides, and religion particularly. I mean, of course, we've just had the death of Pope Francis. That has led to speculation about what the Catholic Church knows or doesn't know or suspects about this subject, what might be in the Vatican archives, what might the new Pope do on this in a situation where previous popes have had this conversation. So there's a lot to play. And I think that even those people that say we're ready for it, there are so many variables. Then there's the COVID experience that, yeah, when the rubber hits the road, it may all go catastrophic anyway.
Stephen Bassett was on the podcast a couple of months ago and sort of surveying what has been happening with the Trump administration since January and this big push for transparency and declassification. And he's been sort of reading the tea leaves, and he thinks that disclosure from the Trump administration could be imminent. I think at that time he thought maybe even mid-April. That time has come and gone. But are you seeing any signals from within the Trump administration, given their at least their promise, of transparency, that indicates they are likely to provide some kind of a disclosure within, let's say, at least the first year or two of this administration?
If the U.S. government or elements in the intelligence community, wherever you think the secret is kept, if there is a smoking gun, this administration, Trump's second term, is the most likely administration ever to disclose, simply because it's such, in one way, it's again, whatever your political beliefs, it's a populist administration, it's a maverick administration, it's a kind of disruptive, and I mean that in a good sense, actually, but mm-hmm. You know, like fighting back, pushing back against the bureaucracy, the deep state, but disruptive administration. And yeah, the signs are good. Obviously, literally the first evening in the Oval Office, President Trump signed a number of executive orders, but one of which related to the declassification and disclosure of JFK records. And then, of course, and this is I think, where the tip of the spear is right now. The establishment of the Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets, currently looking at JFK, but they've very publicly stated that among the other things that they're going to look at, UAP and USOs are pretty much going to be the next thing, and they're gearing up for the next round of hearings. So that's obviously tied in with the House Oversight Committee, a lot of the same people involved, but it's going to be very interesting to see which way that goes. And like I say, I think week commencing May 12th, whenever it is, the exact timeline, but more hearings ahead. And yeah, of course, the problem then becomes, well, what if it isn't the US government corporately sitting on this? What if these are, as has been alleged, illegal programs? Because the challenge then is not just to disclose something, but you can't disclose it until you've actually found it. So assuming that there isn't a smoking gun to hand, step one is find it, and step two is then disclose it. Now, the good news in all of this is that David Grush, of course, one of the best known whistleblowers, is now actively working with some of the people on this task force. So Representative Eric Burleson has literally taken David Grush on as a special advisor. So if that isn't a case of gamekeeper turned poacher, I don't know what is.
Well, let's talk about David Grush. And of course, he dropped that bombshell in 2023 about non-human biologics and crashed craft and so forth. How much weight do you give his claims? And what's Congress going to do to verify stuff like that? How can they?
I give his claims a lot of credence. I mean, this is not some random guy just going around having conversations in a bar or something, or on an internet conspiracy forum. This was somebody in the intelligence community. This was somebody brought onto the UAP task force back when Jay Stratton was director of it. And when David Grush says, I went around and talked to 40 people, 30 or 40 people, whatever, and they verified the reality of these legacy intelligence community programs on crash retrievals and reverse engineering, the people he went around and interviewed were people who he found within the US government, the military, and the intelligence community, because it was Jay Stratton, as director of the UAP task force, who tasked David Grush with, he said, go around, find out who knows what in the system. So David Grush is 30 or 40 people. That's the result of that tasking from Jay Stratton when he said, go find out who knows what. So that should be the sort of synthesis of corporate knowledge in the US intelligence community and the military, other parts of the government, maybe Department of Energy, wherever you think it might be, and some perhaps, you know, unconventional places that people wouldn't think to look. But Grush has apparently delivered a list of witnesses, and he's even split that down into witnesses who would be cooperative and witnesses, pardon me, who might be hostile and who might have to be subpoenaed. Now, without wanting to get too technical, The Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets does not have power of subpoena, but James Comer, who heads up the House Oversight Committee, has pointed out that he does have that power, and he's said that if he feels the task force needs it, he will make sure that that happens.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon. Sometimes the most painful part of getting sick is the getting better part. Waiting on hold for an appointment, sitting in crowded waiting rooms, standing in line at the pharmacy, that's painful. Amazon One Medical and Amazon Pharmacy remove those painful parts of getting better with things like 24/7 virtual visits and prescriptions delivered to your door. Thanks to Amazon Pharmacy and Amazon One Medical, healthcare just got less painful.
This episode is brought to you by Chevy Silverado. When it's time for you to ditch the blacktop and head off-road, do it in a truck that says no to nothing. The Chevy Silverado Trail Boss. Get the rugged capability of its Z71 suspension and 2-inch factory lift. Plus, impressive torque and towing capacity thanks to an available Duramax 3-liter turbo diesel engine. Where other trucks call it quits, you'll just be getting started. Visit Chevy.com to learn more.
Join Target Circle 360 and get a free bouquet of flowers for mom right on time for Mother's Day. From the trendiest styles to the sweetest treats, with Target Circle 360, you can get all her gifts delivered the same day. Hurry, join before Mother's Day and make her day extra special with Target Circle 360 and a bouquet of fresh flowers on us, only at Target. Membership required, subject to terms and conditions. Applies to orders over $35.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back? You're listening to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
We have Aero, the All-Domain Anomalous Research Office, sort of running point on UAP investigations. Are they actually getting anywhere, or is it just another layer of government red tape? I ask this because I recently spoke with Robert Salas and his experiences with UFOs and nukes at Malmstrom Air Force Base back in 1967. He was interviewed by Aero officials, I think by phone. Didn't come away with a great feeling about, you know, Aero and whether they really want to get to the truth. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, firstly, I mean, I'd heard that story, and it's slightly disconcerting to me that he would even be interviewed by telephone. Firstly, that can't be a secure line unless Robert Salas is saying that he went into a nearby military base. But my takeaway is this was just a conversation over an open line, in which case it really couldn't obviously get into anything classified. But also you've got to kind of sit across a table and look into someone's eyes when you're hearing a story like that. And you know, they should have invited him to come in and to bring his best evidence in terms of any documents that he still retains. Obviously he's written a book on this, but bring in an executive summary. And then, or rather, submit that in advance and then task the system with trying to, you know, play red team with it. Say go knock down this story. Then bring him in, have a face-to-face. Just doing it over the phone, it sounds to me like a tick box exercise. That this guy who said that he was involved in this incident, which I absolutely believe he was. I mean, the question is what actually happened. But you know, it's like, well, I guess we've got to kind of hear his testimony, but let's just have him call in. And that's not good enough. And Arrow's reputation is not what it should be. And I think Sean Kirkpatrick, I don't know Sean, I've not met him, but I think particularly with his post-Arrow interviews, he's sent the message that he was never really keen on this. He sort of went in there expecting not to find anything. And that's not really, you should go in with an open mind, a sort of data-led approach. So I think Arrow have some bridges to build and some fences to mend.
Have you been contacted by Arrow? Have you been asked to testify?
I've not, but then, you know, I wouldn't expect to. Firstly, my experience of this is now nearly 30 years in the past. And secondly, of course, my experience is in the UK. Arrow, although they do publish worldwide maps, those tend to be, you know, the rest of the world stuff tends to be in and around US military facilities. So I would not expect to get that call. That being said, obviously I know and have met face to face many many of the, I guess you'd say, sort of players in this field. So whilst I have not yet been asked to formally testify, I mean, I'll characterize it as saying I have a voice at the table.
Let's say you found yourself suddenly the director of Arrow. Who would be your top, let's say, the first three witnesses or experiencers or experts that you would call, and what would be maybe the first question you would ask each?
I think I'd come at it the other way around. I would not re-interview. I mean, obviously they would be on my list. I would want to speak to people like Lou Elizondo, David Grush, Jay Stratton, David Fravor, Ryan Graves, you know, Kevin Day, et cetera, et cetera. But I think I would come at it the other way around, and I would say, I want to go to the Gang of Eight. And I want to say, okay, have you been briefed on any aspects of UAP? And I would want, you know, even if I wasn't read in to programs at that level as director, I would want to hear either, no, we haven't, or yes, we have, but you're not cleared for that. Because that would tell me, I think, something very important. Because frankly, we're getting to the point where either this is, or these are, illegal programs, completely illegal, and therefore there is no oversight. Or the oversight, if it exists, can only really be Gang of Eight. If Congress has been going at this for as long as they have, both in the Senate and the House, in the intelligence committees, the armed services committees, the oversight committees, and still not uncovering a smoking gun.
Who do you mean by the Gang of Eight, Nick?
The Gang of Eight, the eight congressional representatives who really are cleared at the highest levels for special access programs and for unacknowledged special access programs and for waived special unacknowledged programs. I'm sorry, it's such a bureaucratic mouthful, all of this. But essentially, those people in the US Congress who have the highest clearances for certain special programs that are so highly classified and so deeply compartmentalized that not even the usual congressional committees are briefed in a corporate sense. Maybe, you know, the Senate majority leader, the Senate minority leader, the heads, just the chairman of a couple of key committees. So the gang of eight, the most highly cleared folks in Congress.
Right. One would assume the director of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be someone who would be read into some of these programs, and yet you can remember the individual who supposedly sort of confessed in an off-the-record interview that as the director of intelligence at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was denied being read into such a program. Do you remember that incident?
Now, was that the Admiral Wilson?
Yes.
The story that, yeah. Well, now, of course, this is tricky because I think Wilson now denies some of the material in the memo that was written about this supposed meeting. So I guess one thing would be, well, let's subpoena Wilson. But there are a number of other people who you would sort of say, well, this person should know. I mean, DNI, Director of National Intelligence, should know. It was previously Avril Haines. Before that, it was John Ratcliffe, who's now back as CIA director. Mm-hmm. John Ratcliffe, when he was Director of National Intelligence, went on, it was after he was DNI, but on a Fox News interview, he alluded to the fact, for example, that the satellite imagery of UAP, which is something we've never seen. We've seen the forward-looking infrared films taken from the US Navy jets. We've seen footage taken from other platforms, but we've not seen any satellite imagery yet.
Right, right. So I think that would be a great idea, subpoenaing former Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Wilson. That'd be a great place to start. Tulsi Gabbard is the new head of DNI. What are your thoughts on her quest for transparency? And do you think that she would be aware of any of these unacknowledged programs and whether she'll try to get read in, as it were?
I think this is where it comes back to, are they just very, very highly classified? In which case, she's only just got her feet under the table, but hopefully she will push for this. Or are they literally illegal? Are we talking about some sort of, or a gray area? You know, you could look at the historical precedent of something like Iran-Contra, and you can even to this day have a debate about whether it was legal or not. And then you can say, until and unless something gets to court, you can't really test that. And all anyone actually has is an opinion, like, oh, I think it was illegal. But then if the commander in chief, in his capacity as commander in chief, says, go do something, and you do it, arguably, are you not following a lawful order from your commander in chief? So again, and until and unless these sorts of things get to court, you can't even say with any degree of certainty whether something is an illegal program or not. But I come back to the point that this is a maverick regime, and if they find it, whatever it is, I think they likely will disclose it.
You mentioned pilot Ryan Graves, and he's been talking about, you know, near misses with UAPs in restricted airspace. How do you suppose the military is rethinking air defense to handle objects that move like nothing we've got?
I think you have to approach that as a sort of blue skies thinking. But I think the military more generally is now configured on new threats. I mean, gone are the days of land, sea, and air. Well, they're not gone, but they've been supplanted by land, sea, air, space, and cyberspace. And then when it comes to asymmetric warfare, hybrid warfare, obviously two things that are linked that people are looking at are drones and AI, and particularly AI controlled drone swarms. And the idea that you could have a drone or a swarm of drones where each individual one is the size of an insect, and you could give them some loose commands, but thereafter they have the autonomy through AI to react in real time to changing circumstances. I mean, that's a very hard threat to defend against. So whether you're talking about UAP moving in these extraordinary ways, or whether you're talking about, for example, China developing AI-controlled drone swarms, you have to have that same mindset where you have to kind of say, well, look, you know, forget the old school thinking about if your jet flies above height X, you're safe from ground-to-air missiles, or if you're, you know, this speed or this maneuverability. We're in a new world with new threats.
Speaking of AI, you've got groups like the Galileo Project using AI and other tech to hunt for UAPs. Do you think this could finally give us the hard data we've been waiting for?
Yes, absolutely. And I should declare an interest. Although I'm not a scientist, I'm actually a research affiliate or an affiliate in the Galileo Project. And absolutely, Professor Avi Loeb said from the very outset, we're not doing any kind of, you know, new physics here. We're not, you know, we are using the scientific method. We are using the standard model, and we're going to collect data. We're going to design instruments. We're going to gather data. We're going to make hypotheses, test them, retest them, analyze the results. I mean, just standard science. Apply that to UAP. It sounds easy. It sounds common sense, but very few people have done it before. But yeah, this is absolutely the way to go.
Avi Loeb has suggested UAP.
Hey there, travelers. Kaylee Cuoco here. Sorry to interrupt your music. Great artist, BT Dubs. But wouldn't you rather be there to hear it live? With Priceline, you can get out of your dreams and into your dream concert. They've got millions of travel deals to get you to that festival, gig, rave, soundbath, or sonic experience you've been dreaming of. Download the Priceline app today, and you can save up to 60% off hotels and up to 50% off flights. So don't just dream about that trip. Book it with Priceline.
Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The new McCrispy strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy strip dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
These could be probes from an advanced civilization. How is that idea, do you think, holding up against the data we've got so far?
Well, again, you know, you don't need to invent or even take a conceptual leap and sort of start talking about warp drive and wormholes, even if such things are possible. Because you can say, given the age of the universe and what we know about the cycles of star formation, just only assuming the level of technology we have. So, for example, five probes that have either left or are about to leave the solar system, depending on where you define the boundary. But, you know, basically the Pioneer probes and the Voyager probes. An extraterrestrial civilization or multiple civilizations that might have got started a billion years before us, might be a billion years further down the road, they could have sent out, even if, let's just suppose, I don't believe this, but let's just suppose you couldn't get any more advanced than Pioneer and Voyager tech. Well, a civilization that got a billion year head start on us could have seeded the galaxy with those sorts of probes, and they should be detectable. Again, they're not. There's no spooky Star Trek technology required. No faster than light travel, no cloaking. There are just probes that we know are possible because we've built them and sent them ourselves. We just, you know, had we aimed those probes at Proxima Centauri at the speed they're going, they would take about 75,000 years to get there. But with, you know, compared to that billion year head start I mentioned, that's nothing. So let's, as Avi Loeb said, let's just use science and the standard model and let's just look. Let's make a hypothesis. His hypothesis is that these probes might exist. Well, let's use science to try and find them.
So I suppose we could contrast that perspective with Luis Elizondo's, who's been saying UAPs will likely challenge our understanding of reality itself. I mean, first of all, do you buy that? Or again, is it more likely we're just missing some key tech explanation?
Yeah, Lou's not wrong. And the Avi Loeb's position and Lou's position are not, I think, mutually exclusive, because of course, I think Lou's point here is that there is, you know, you can talk about the laws of physics, but what we're really saying is the laws of physics as we currently understand them. And of course, history has shown multiple times our understanding of the laws of physics changes. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, well, you know, it's all relative, that the steady state theory was replaced by the Big Bang theory. And now, given the observations about the rapid expansion in in the speed of the expansion of the universe, it seems that we might have to rethink the Big Bang Theory, or at least factor in things that when I was a kid growing up were not, you know, on the agenda, things like dark energy and dark matter, of course, I'm talking about. So I don't think Lou and Avi's positions are incompatible here. And I think Lou might be right when he said that there will be things coming up that will challenge our sense of reality. But that's not to say they are counter to the laws of physics. Like I say, it's just going to be that the laws of physics are going to be even more bizarre and strange and multifaceted than we currently realize. And it's a pretty bizarre and multifaceted thing as it is.
Getting back to David Grush and his testimony about secret UFO crash retrieval programs and so forth, and when we couple that with statements by people like Bob Lazar and talking about back engineering technology, and then we get into Richard Dolan's discussions about a breakaway civilization. They have this technology, they're off planet, and so forth. If these programs are in fact deemed to be illegal, and let's say, you know, there have been stories about people being murdered in order to, you know, maintain this lid of secrecy. And we have this, assuming we have this separate secret space program. Meanwhile, for public consumption, we're still launching people into space using rocket fuel, very dangerous. People, astronauts have died as a result for maintaining what would essentially be a lie. I mean, talk to me about your thoughts about granting, let's say, immunity to some of these people responsible who are still alive for keeping this lid on the secrecy in exchange for just disclosure. How do you feel about that?
I think it's tricky. I mean, actually, I say it is tricky, but I'm a great fan of Gordian knot style solutions. So yeah, the easy answer to this would be an executive order giving blanket amnesty to anyone who acted in good faith. And I think that's, you know, it's a broad enough phrase, but I think we, you know, you can't define it, but you know it when you see it, or rather flip that around, you know bad faith when you see it. So I think it would be very easy to do an executive order whereby you say, if anyone is sitting on what they believe is a UAP-related smoking gun because you believe that you are still bound by an NDA or whatever, this executive order not only releases you from that, but compels you to come and testify, for example, to the task force on the disclosure of federal secrets. And then the retrospective pardon, like the one Fauci got long before there was even a talk of legal action. So it's easy to do. There's precedent for doing it. You would just say anyone who acted in good faith on this, took any action, any good faith action to protect UAP secrecy, is hereby, under the authority of this executive order, presidential executive order, given a full and retrospective pardon. So then I think, and now if you haven't already, this is a conversation to have with, I think, Danny Sheehan, because he knows obviously the law way better than a layperson like myself. But even if you got this executive order and a pardon, release people from the NDAs, pardon them for past actions, and I've heard everything, you know, people to say, well, what about class actions from the abductees or class actions here, there? All that's off the table if there's an executive order and whatever. But you would still have, and Danny Sheehan has had involvement with these sorts of things, you'd still have, I think, you would want to have a sort of truth and reconciliation committee, where everyone basically has the chance to say, well, look, this is what happened to us. And from the other side of the table, it's, well, this is what we did, but here's why.
Right.
Actually worked quite well. It worked quite well I mean, maybe it's unraveling now, but you could look at the historical perspective of the end of apartheid in South Africa. There are some problems there again now, but nonetheless, at the time, that all worked as well as these things could be expected to work. The Northern Ireland peace process was, again, it's not like there aren't still those tensions, but in terms of what how it used to be and how it is now, and again, there was a sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission there. So there are historical models and precedents for how this might work.
And based on your experience, decades and decades of experience and research, do you believe, in fact, that people have been murdered in order to maintain this lid of secrecy?
I don't know. I mean, I obviously have not been read onto the programs that David Grush was. So if he says that in good faith, I will accept that. I have seen no evidence of it myself. I do find it difficult to believe for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because I think most people who sit in government, even on these sorts of programs, they're not James Bond villains. You know, they're pretty much everyone I know who has been in government, the military, the intelligence community, have done that because they are essentially good people who want to make the world a better place. So I don't like to believe that. Now, obviously, history shows us that good people can do bad things. Bad people can always do bad things. And there will always be a few bad apples. Also, I find it difficult to believe just because there are other ways to do it. I mean, you know, why not give someone a final warning? Mm. And say, hey, look, you were in the system. You know what we're capable of. Let me tell you, don't do X, otherwise Y. So I find it difficult to believe, but not impossible to believe.
Right, right. We also tend to do a pretty good job of discrediting whistleblowers through the media and so forth.
Yes, as happened to David Grush himself, of course, with elements in the intelligence community effectively saying to a particular journalist, dig here. And no, technically, they didn't give him the story. But they said, look, if you put in a Freedom of Information Act request to this police department at this time frame, you'll find something interesting. And he did. And he turned up the family member calling the local cops with concern about Dave Grush's state of mind because he had PTSD, which stemmed not because the guy's nuts, which was obviously what they wanted to imply, but because he had seen some pretty horrendous things when he was serving in Afghanistan. But yeah, that's the kind of dirty tricks that goes on. So you don't need to kill people. I mean, if you kill someone, you make them a martyr. If you cast aspersions to the point that someone either thinks you're a nut job or laughs at you or both, that's far more effective and far more, I mean, it's not a moral thing to do, but it's a much more moral thing than killing someone.
Nick, again, Contact in the Desert, May 29th to June 2nd. Just give us a tease about your presentation.
Well, actually, I think you mentioned to disclose or not to disclose. Maybe they haven't updated that part of the website, but I thought that was my presentation last year.
Okay.
There is kind of going to be, well, you know what? No. I think you're right, but there was a subtitle maybe. And the subtitle is, and again, I touched on it earlier, but Lessons from the Pandemic. And what I'm going to be doing I'm going to be doing three things at Contact in the Desert, four things. My main presentation, which is about how, you know, what lessons can we learn from the mishandling of the COVID pandemic when it comes to disclosure. And we've touched on that in our conversation. So that's my main presentation. My workshop is going to be an Ask Me Anything. Just I will give the people the floor. I'm also going to be sitting on a number of panels And the fourth thing, which is just as important, I think, is that I'm going to be there for the entire time, just wandering around, mingling with people, chatting. Sometimes at live events, you don't get an opportunity to meet people because you're walled off from the public. Other events, you do. This is a mingle kind of event. So at the end of every evening, you usually find the speakers come down to the bar for a couple of cold ones and mm-hmm. and just hang out with whoever's there. And some of the most interesting and deep conversations that you'll ever have at Contact in the Desert are just those casual conversations at the end of the day at the bar. And I will be there, and I know that many, many of the other speakers will be there too. And I'm looking forward to it. It's a great conference. You know, amazing range of people there, and it's a friendly conference. Like I say, everyone mingles and chats and has fun.
Contact in the Desert, May 29th to June 2nd. Contactinthedesert.com for tickets and more information. Nick, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.